This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Hello, I'm Carol Crist. I'm the director of the Center for Studies in Higher Education. I'm delighted to welcome you here to this presentation by Professor Raj Kumar. He was the founding vice chancellor of O.P. Jindal Global University, or JGU, in India at the age of 34 in 2009. So you were a child prodigy in university leadership. Professor Kumar is currently the dean of the Jindal Global Law School and director of the International Institute for Higher Education Research and Capacity Building. He has degrees from the University of Oxford, Harvard University, the University of Hong Kong, the University of Delhi, and Loyola College. So he is really a globally educated person. He's also a member of the National Legal Knowledge Council and was a faculty member at the School of Law at the City University of Hong Kong. Professor Kumar's areas of specialization include human rights and development, terrorism and national security, corruption and governance, law and disaster management, comparative constitutional law, and legal education and higher education. So an enormously broad array of critical topics. He has over 150 publications to his name and is widely published in peer-reviewed journals. And he's going to talk to us today about a topic that I'm sure fascinates most of us, the crisis of higher education in India. How can public policy and governance reforms help? So please welcome Professor Kumar.
Very good morning to all of you. Thank you very much, Professor Carol Crist, former provost as well as director for the Center for Studies in Higher Education. I would also like to thank Diana for putting together this talk. Also, Dean Brady for welcoming me here at the Goldman School of Public Policy and the Center for Studies in Higher Education. Also, a good old friend, Sudhash Shetty, for being present here and to help us navigate through different aspects of collaborative initiatives that we have with UC Berkeley. I'm very delighted to be here and also in particular to be at the Center for Studies in Higher Education because I do believe that these centers of higher education studies are so critical for the future of institution building. In that spirit and having drawn a lot of inspiration from the leading universities in the United States, we in India at Jindal Global University just barely a year and a half ago, established the International Institute for Higher Education Research and Capacity Building. Before I begin the talk itself, I want to mention about that institute a little bit. One of the earliest initiatives that institute that we have at Jindal did was to collaborate with the Times Higher Education in London and hosted a major international conference last December on why emerging economies need world-class universities. And I was very pleased to know that Times Higher Education is collaborating with UC Berkeley this year, and later this year, UC Berkeley will be hosting the Times Higher Education's conference here at Berkeley. As an outcome document of that conference, we have what is known as the Sonipat Declaration, which I have shared with you, copy of which talks about the need for building world-class universities in the BRICS and emerging economies. It is aspirational nature. It talks about a number of ideas and perspectives that are central to the vision of establishing and evolving world-class universities. My talk today will draw upon many of my academic writings, some of which I've shared with you, but also another book that I just completed and which looks at the President of India and the governance of higher education institutions. That book, in more extensive details, talks about the need for both public policy and regulatory reforms and governance reforms in the field of higher education. Just to lay down the broad framework before I talk about the challenges, and what I intend to do is I don't intend to do a PowerPoint presentation. This is the only slide you're going to have, and I'm going to talk about many aspects of this slide, but also briefly talk about, along the way, I will talk about the public policy and governance reforms that are needed in addressing each of these challenges. Just to give you a perspective of Indian higher education, which in itself is overwhelming, India has little over 750 universities. India has nearly 50,000 colleges, and these colleges are different forms of colleges. You know, private colleges, publicly created colleges, affiliated colleges, and all kinds of different types of colleges. And then you have over 5,000 business schools, which are standalone business schools affiliated to a university, because only a university has the degree awarding authority. And then you have little over 1,300 law schools. So it's a relatively large higher education establishment, and at times even overwhelming. At the dawn of Indian independence in the year 1947, we had only 20 universities. And in the last 60 years, the higher education sector has dramatically and quite substantially expanded. However, there are many challenges, and I've used the word crisis of higher education quite consciously, because I do believe that the higher education system in India is facing different forms of crisis, and we need to respond to it. And I do hope that public policy, governance, and regulated reforms can address some of these challenges. It's also useful to mention that there was a point of time in history India did play an extraordinary leadership role in higher education. I had the privilege to be a Rhodes Scholar at the University of Oxford, where I've studied at a college called University College Oxford, and it was founded in the year 1249. And when I was a student in the year 1999, the master of University College used to always say that we are the oldest college in the English-speaking world, and we were celebrating the 750th anniversary in the year 1999. So in one of those occasions, I was very intrigued by his constant reference to the oldest college in the English-speaking world, and I said, so why do you always say this? Well, he said, you know, your country had universities long before, and he reminded me about the Nalanda University and the Takshashila University, which were founded over 2,000 years ago. Nalanda University at its peak had over 10,000 students. It was a multidisciplinary university with students learning astronomy to algebra to philosophy to literature to music to theater. So that type of leadership was played by India at a point of time in history. Of course, Nalanda was destroyed, but there is an effort to, you know, reinvent and recreate Nalanda, and there has been a university created through an effort by many South Asian and Southeast Asian governments. But be that as it may, the larger problem of India is also a question of how do we respond to the contemporary challenges of higher education. So with that sort of preface, let me just begin by saying that this crisis that I am talking about in the Indian higher education system is embedded into a larger set of problems and challenges, right from creating the vision and mission of institution to many other things. So I will go on. I'll just follow this and maybe end in 20 minutes, which will give us some time to raise questions about these issues. I do believe that most, if not all, Indian universities have not been created with a view to providing transformative leadership within the country. It has not been created with a vision and mission to seek and address some of the most fundamental challenges that are confronting the world at large, let alone the Indian society. There is high levels of mediocrity deeply embedded into both the creation as well as the evolution of most of Indian universities. This mediocrity has resulted in a situation where the crisis is deeply embedded in almost every aspect of governance in relation to higher education. I can just mention in the context of vision and mission that if you, for example, look at the central universities of the country, which are really leading institutions of the country, and many of those institutions have provided a lot of leadership as well as contribution towards research and knowledge creation. These are the universities such as my own alma mater, the University of Delhi, the Jawaharlal Nehru University, and many other institutions. There are nearly 45 central universities of the country. Believe it or not, these universities have approximately 40% faculty positions lying vacant, unfilled. The IITs and IIMs, which we are very proud of and who have contributed significantly towards ideas and perspectives, but also leadership in technology and innovation, including the development of Silicon Valley, I have to confess that these institutions have approximately 35% faculty positions lying vacant. And of course, these are not, question of lack of resources, but the heart of the problem of these faculty positions lying vacant is a question of governance, and we will come back to it all through the talk. So in some ways, the vision and mission of Indian higher education institution needs to be reinvented and radically transformed with a view to addressing the issue of quality, but also to fulfill another aspiration of India, which is to be able to create world-class institutions. And towards the end of the talk, I'll tell a little bit about what could be the future. The second major issue in this is the question of autonomy and regulation. It's recognized widely that Indian higher education institutions are over-regulated and under-governed. And that also means that there is a sort of a labyrinth of regulation in India, pretty much to regulate everything that an institution does. So right from, formulation of curriculum to co-structure to program development to faculty recruitment plan to student admissions process to formulation of courses to curriculum to also to assessment to examinations, there is not a single aspect of higher education is not regulated by the government. And the government at various levels regulated. Sometimes they regulate through regulatory bodies created, such as the University Grants Commission, the Bar Council of India, the Medical Council of India, and many other such regulatory bodies. And many of these regulations have had noble intentions when they were created, institutional mechanisms with a view to maintaining quality. However, over the years, these regulatory mechanisms have undermine the ability of Indian institutions to evolve and clearly develop visions and imaginations on their own. There is also a major challenge with regard to regulation. Most of these regulations have envisaged the idea of the most crooked form of institutional imagination to their belief that, and every attempt to create that regulation is to somehow stop the dubious people to be able to do, to stop them from doing things that are, not in the best interest of institutions. But in that process, any new imagination, innovation, creativity that educational institutions and universities could provide is not possible because of those regulation. And clearly, institutions suffer from lack of autonomy, including the autonomy that comes with the leadership of institutions themselves. There is so much of difference to what the central government and the state government and the regulatory bodies would like to do. And institutions are constantly differing to what could be the potential interest of the governments, regardless of whichever government in power. In fact, if there is one bipartisan consensus in this matter, is the fact that every government which comes to power is clearly wanting to regulate higher education and regulate it more. So in some ways, if we really want to look at public policy and governance reforms to respond to this challenge, we need to look at the fundamental objectives of regulation. What is the purpose of regulation? How do we regulate institutions, higher education institutions, yet maintaining autonomy and also, more importantly, promote creativity and institutional imagination within the institutions? To what extent government bodies and regulatory bodies can work collaboratively with the leadership and the faculty within the academic institutions to be able to address some of the big challenges of higher education? The third is a big issue relating to funding and resources. Now, of course, this ties in with the next point, which I'm going to make about public and private. One of the things that India is aspiring to do is to be able to create opportunities for the young people of India. You may be aware that 800 million people in India are less than 35 years of age out of the 1.3 billion people. Just look at that figure, 800 million people less than 35 years of age. And of course, India's life expectancy is increasing quite substantially, and these 800 million people are going to be living longer. This also ties in well with a situation where good part of the Western world, the demographic dividend that India is going to have is going to be an important competitive factor when good part of the Western world and large parts of the Eastern world will become old. Older, India will remain younger and will be younger for a longer time. All of this means that this demographic dividend that we have in India can only be benefited for both India and the world at large if we can focus on higher education and the opportunities that we're going to give for the young people. And that also means that you need resources. Now, successive governments have not been able to prioritize the higher education sector. The percentage in GDP which we would like to have in towards higher education spending is not seen, and there is a lot of effort every time to galvanize political consciousness towards that. But unfortunately, among many other priorities of the governments that come to power, higher education has not been one. Of course, we also have a challenge of the multi-layered framework of Indian higher education system. I mentioned about the complexity of the higher education sector. Briefly, you have the central universities, which are created through the parliamentary legislation process. You have the state universities, which are created through the state legislative assembly processes. Of course, you have the private universities in the states, which are also created through the state assembly processes. You have also the deemed universities, which are created through the regulatory process within the Government of India through the University Grants Commission and the Ministry of Human Resource Development. With this complexity of different types of institutions, the funding and resources framework does face a challenge. If there are challenges to the public universities in general, which are created by the state government, there is also a lot of stress in relation to the private universities because, that comes back to the point about the public versus private, which is the fact that in India, even today, private is pejorative. The large Indian higher education establishment historically has evolved through the governmental investments in public sector and public education, and the large universities continue to be public education, publicly funded. However, it is also a fact that steadily the funding relating to the various disciplines are being reduced quite significantly. In fact, many areas such as disciplines relating to humanities and social sciences are under serious threat. And so, and of course, more and more attempts to create professional education, educational cadre in relation to advancing professional education has become the norm in many of the public policy interventions. All of this means that we need a lot more resources. And unfortunately, most of the effort to create resources is only coming through governmental initiatives and not outside the government. In fact, the extraordinary evolution of great public and private institutions in this country is a stellar example of how both the public and the private universities are seeking resources outside the government. And the growth and evolution of philanthropy is something which we in India need to invest quite substantially. And we also need to recognize that the public or private character of universities is more to do with their functioning and their outcomes and their contributions and less about their creation. And this is something which India needs to recognize sooner than later, although things have become much better now than, say, two decades ago when the idea of private universities was completely anathematic to the idea of higher education. Of course, I am very conscious personally about the need for private, not-for-profit, philanthropic oriented higher education institutions. I am personally opposed to the idea of for-profit institutions, and I do believe that education should continue to be a public good, a common good worth investing, and investing by both the public sector as well as the private sector. In this regard, there are a number of innovative measures that are elsewhere proposed, including a need for substantially drawing upon an important legislative measure that India took a few years ago, which is to pass legislation for corporate social responsibility, CSR funding. In fact, India is probably the only country in the world which has actually created a legislative framework which requires, in some form, the private sector, the multinational corporations, as well as Indian companies and corporations and business enterprises to contribute 2% of their profits towards CSR funding. And of course, this is very interesting because it is not mandated. However, the corporations are expected to provide a compliance mechanism and a reporting obligation why they are not doing this. Of course, this creates an opportunity for corporations to, there is a shaming process as well, but there is a high degree of compliance in this measure, although as to where the money is being invested and really going is a subject matter for huge controversy. There have been instances when corporations have contributed CSR funding towards employee welfare and other kinds of things which are clearly not what CSR funding was expected to go. However, there is a clear recognition that billions of dollars are indeed going to be generated through the CSR process of 2% as the Indian economic growth has been moving towards consistently between 6 to 7% and the next couple of years might even go to 8 to 10%. If that is the kind of economic growth that India is going to witness, it will also mean that a large number of companies and corporations, their own income and their profits will increase and their own contributions towards CSR will increase. All of that means that we need to go beyond the expectation that the state is going to fund higher education. And although one should argue and probably exhort pressure in the, on the state to contribute to that. So in some ways, this existing dichotomy that prevails between public and private institutions need to be significantly altered, and that we need to recognize the cost of higher education is a responsibility for everybody, including the public and the private sector. We also need to recognize that education, higher education in particular, should be a not-for-profit activity in which in which private contributions should be based upon philanthropy as well as ability to create institutional excellence in these institutions. I can only, for those of you who are interested in why I strongly believe in this notion, I can refer you to an absolutely stellar book by a Harvard political philosopher named Michael Sandel. His book is titled "Why What Money Can't Buy: The Moral Limits of Markets," in which he talks about the idea of increasingly we have moved into a society where everything is up for sale and you can buy. And he talks about the consequences of such a society where everything is up for sale and you can buy it. And the two consequences being corruption and inequalities. He, of course, makes a reference to the United States, but this could be arguably connected to almost every society in the world, including India. So that's the question of public versus private. I quickly move on to the other challenges relating to universities, including teaching and pedagogy. Now, this is, of course, a major concern in India, the question of faculty, as well as the central role of universities to be institutions where both knowledge creation that happens through research, but also dissemination, as well as experiential learning and inspiring ecosystem for faculty to engage with students. Now, here, the big challenge that India is facing today is the question of who are the people who are coming into teaching. The fact remains that teaching is no longer an attractive profession in a number of ways. In fact, I've not personally done any empirical research on that, but since I moved to India in the year 2008 in the process of building a university in India, I had the privilege and opportunity to deliver over 3,000 talks across the country in schools and colleges and universities, and regardless of the schools that I have spoken across the different states in India from north, south, and east and west. At the end of my talk in these schools and colleges and universities, including in IITs and IIMs, I have asked a question to the students, the question was, how many of you would like to become a teacher, would like to become a professor? And the answer, without exception, across institutions, across regions, has been nil, 1%, if at all. So there is a huge degree of mediocrity that is deeply institutionalized in higher education institutions, where not only the best and the brightest are not aspiring to come into higher education, but even the second best. And so this is a very, very serious problem that we need to address as to how do we create new forms of vision and imagination that will bring in many Indian students and graduates to come into academia. Of course, while all of this is happening, many of the Indian academics have become leading academic scholars in the Western world. If you look at the last 2 to 3 decades, you would find an extraordinary increase in Indian academics becoming professors across the United States, but also many other universities around the world. And by the way, these These are not the Indians who are born and brought up in the United States. I am talking about the Indians who have studied in India, went to school and college and university in India, and had come to the United States for their higher education, and then go on to take up academic positions here. And of course, the point which I am really drawing your attention is that academia across disciplines in India is not an attractive proposition for graduates in many disciplines. And so this is something which we need to address, and we see this mediocrity deeply embedded, and because of which both teaching and pedagogy relating to teaching are affected. A related point is the fact that while academic freedom is important and indeed central to university governance, there is also need for talking about accountability of academics themselves. Most Indian institutions, particularly public but also private, would not have had an opportunity to let the students assess the performance of the teachers in classroom at all. The idea of a teaching feedback questionnaire is largely anathematic to the Indian higher education establishment, and if any attempts to infuse even a marginal degree of accountability will lead to stiff resistance from most academic institutions, and that's something which we need to address. I also want to highlight quickly the research and knowledge creation aspect of it. One of the reasons why not a single Indian university is one of the top 200 in the Times Higher Education rankings, or for the matter, other rankings, is the fact that good part of the methodology for assessing these universities constitutes research and publications and citations. At best, Indian institutions are teaching institutions, and if they do that well, but if they don't do that well, most of them may not do that, but none of them are truly research institutions. And of course, we know that for research to happen, you need outstanding faculty, you need an ecosystem, you need, of course, funding and resources, you need all kinds of support, and that is why there is a major challenge in relation to creating opportunities for research and knowledge creation. Because of which we have a challenge in relation to the contribution of faculty towards publications, and poor citations has also affected the ability of Indian institutions to play a leadership role. The growth and evolution of Indian institutions in the last several decades is primarily is a story of expansion and not one of promoting excellence. So, this is a very sad story in some ways, because in our effort to provide access to education to a large number of people, we have neglected the need for maintaining even minimal standards of quality that can indeed aspire to promote excellence. So in some ways, even with this expansion, or the focus on expansion, the gross enrollment ratio in India is approximately 22 to 24%, and our aspiration is to reach over 30 to 35% in the years to come. But of course, for that, we need to have another, as it was predicted by education minister a few years ago in the previous government, that we need 1,000 new universities in the next 10 to 15 years if we were to increase the gross enrollment ratio from what we have to another 10 points above. Of course, we did not create 1,000 new universities because we knew that we didn't even have faculty members for the existing universities, and of course, resources and all of that. So we need to address the question of how do we create opportunities for different and diversified institutional imaginations. We need to question the way in which we have built our higher education sector, in which a strong degree of mediocrity and lack of accountability has been the norm. We need to really innovatively think about how do we attract the best of the faculty members in high schools and colleges to think about higher education. At present, it is not uncommon that to say that the bottom 10, 20, or even 30% of the graduates may enter into higher education. But how do we attract the top 20% of graduating students across different disciplines to think about coming into academia in India? What are the institutional mechanisms that are needed that ought to be designed, including the ecosystem, be it in relation to compensation, funding, resources, as well as grants, as well as other things that are needed to create that ecosystem, is something which we need to think about. I also want to briefly discuss about rankings and assessment. I think one of the promising things that have happened in India. Of course, there are a number of controversies surrounding rankings. Rankings anywhere is controversial, including in this country. While rankings are controversial, we all know that if you talk to the provost and the presidents of universities, they would somewhat say that rankings are not everything. But you know what? Berkeley comes in the top, whatever university, we're happy. So this story is not uncommon, be it in Oxford or Cambridge, but also in other parts of the world. So we need to be conscious of that. But at the same time, what rankings does is it shows some sort of a mirror in the way in which an institution is functioning, and how do you benchmark yourself with other institutions, but more importantly, how do we assess the performance of these institutions and what really counts. But in some ways, what is important and valuable may not at times be counted, and what is probably not so valuable gets counted. So rankings have their limitations. Having said that, the contemporary effort to respond to these challenges in India is actually driven by the new forms of political processes that are highlighting the fact that not a single Indian university is one of the top 200 in the world. It's a bit like what, you know, many years ago the United Nations Development Program did with the Human Development Index, and began ranking the countries in relation to the Human Development Index and their performance in those various HDI indicators. And of course, later came the Global Corruption Report of the Transparency International, and became even more, countries became defensive about the fact that their corruption mirror is shown. But of course, in spite of all the controversy surrounding these reports, governments tend to take that seriously. There are internal regulatory and policy and governance reforms initiated by the pressure that is exerted through the rankings. And so I have to confess that the Times Higher Education, the QS rankings, as well as the Shanghai Jitong rankings, are creating some sort of attraction. It's shaking up an old giant, an elephant, in waking up from its long slumber. And so I do believe that rankings have an important, triggering factor, and it is happening as we speak in India. At the same time, this current effort to galvanize certain consciousness, academic consciousness and intellectual consciousness in India in relation to improving quality and standards cannot be a myopic approach purely driven by the effort to get some of the Indian universities in the top 200. It has to be more systemic and more sustainable, and that involves, as I said, a reassessment of the regulatory architecture and the public policy that is currently focusing on higher education. I also want to end, lastly, I want to briefly mention that any reform effort in India in higher education needs to recognize the larger focus of institution building. Institution building is central to nation building. If we start recognizing that institution building is central to nation building, then we start valuing higher education institutions much more. Unfortunately, that may not be the case in India. There is enormous intellectual capital that is prevailing here in the country. There's something to be said about the growth and evolution of ideas, and that is definitely there. But unfortunately, institutions ought to be the bedrock around which these ideas get evolved and nurtured. And that is where we have a long way to go. I believe that we need to draw huge inspiration from the leading universities around the world, including the University of California at Berkeley. I do believe that some of the collaborative initiatives that are being pursued here at this university with Indian universities augurs well for India attempting to seek some transformative change in the higher education sector, which is what is important for us to recognize. And I think it's important in this country to recognize is that the Indian story is not the story of the IITs and the IIMs alone. It will be unfair and rather unfortunate to look at India from the prism of the few prestigious institutions which have no doubt made significant contributions towards knowledge creation as well as innovation. And even you go deeper into these institutions, a large part of their success also is owed to the students and the graduates and the kind of exclusion that happens in the application process. We have a billion plus people, and obviously there are several thousand people very, very smart to get into these institutions. But the question really is that what do institutions do to shape their thinking? What kind of transformative opportunities that are available for students in Indian higher education institutions which can help them carve out a vision and imagination for not only themselves but also for the countries and the world at large? To what extent an ecosystem that is firing their imagination is prevailing in our higher education institutions? These are critical questions that need to be asked and addressed. There are, of course, cross-cutting issues such as internationalization and regulatory reform, which can be talked about. But I will stop here. I will end by saying that the public policy surrounding higher education is largely driven by a much more myopic and narrow political, at time even institutional interest, which doesn't cater to the vision of creating a higher education system. I do believe that if we were to play a leadership role for the next century, we need to look at different models around the world and draw inspiration from. I personally think the experience of China in the last three decades of radically transforming some of its leading universities and to be able to create an opportunity for many scholars in China to advance their higher education system is a telling example. While China has a number of challenges, but it is also another country which has that billion plus people, and then to look at the comparative situation that prevailing in both these countries, public policy interventions in relation to higher education system has been far more effective in China than we have seen in India. Also, the question of transformative leadership that needs to drive the agenda of higher education is something that we need to draw a lot of inspiration from here. I have elsewhere jokingly mentioned, although not so jokingly, is the fact that the possibility of many higher education leaders in India to be able to come and assume a leadership role here, some of whom, let's say, are not as visionary as they ought to be. Their ability to damage institutions in here is far less because of the deep-rooted, sustained mechanisms that prevail in the leading institutions in the United States. We ought to draw inspiration from that evolution. And the second aspect of United States in particular is the relatively lesser disparities that prevail between the top institutions that we all know in this country and the institutions which are not so top, and they are probably below in any ranking. But I do believe that the quality of those institutions are pretty good. That also means that the disparity between these institutions are far less, and the quality of higher education that is generally offered is pretty good. So in some ways we have a long way to go. The idea of institution building in India is so central because we can't lose hope in India. 800 million people and 1.3 billion people, these numbers are huge numbers that should make the world look at India far more seriously than it has looked before. It also means that the possibility of change and reform is so central. You know, I come from a city in India called Chennai. It is in South India. And there is a college in Chennai which is called Presidency College. I don't know how many of you know about this college. Now, Presidency College produced two Nobel laureates. There are countries in the world which doesn't have one Nobel laureate. But in India, you have one city with one college producing two Nobel laureates. Sir C.V. Raman and Chandrasekhar, both of them were students at Presidency College. Now, of course, I am conscious of the fact that this talk is recorded, and so I don't want to go into details of what Presidency College really is today, but I will invite you to visit that college and look for yourself what we have done. In some ways, we have a very myopic vision for higher education and institution building, and there is no way to respond to this challenge unless we look at some of these models that are taking place in different parts of the world and to invest in higher education and university. universities. So I would like to end by once again thanking Professor Christ, as well as the Center for the Studies in Higher Education and the Goldman School of Public Policy for giving me this opportunity to come and reflect some of these ideas. Many of the ideas that I've shared with you have been in the articles that I have distributed to all of you. I'll be happy to take questions. Thank you for your patience.
Thank you, sir. You are well aware of the fact that there are people occupying positions at universities and high schools who are, say, math teachers who do not know basic formulas in their own subject. So how come you did not say a word about that? And how harmful it is, everybody knows that.
Yes. Well, I mentioned about it in the question of faculty itself. We have a very tragic situation where many of the faculty members across disciplines are not only not qualified, but probably even are not interested to be able to actually be in academic institution, because they have probably not got jobs elsewhere. This mediocrity has affected the ability of them to contribute effectively. So I share your concerns on that.
But could we expect them to pass some exam before they are offered teacher's position?
So, you know, you'll be very surprised that there are such examination. I can go into details with you, but the fact remains that many of these examination-based systems of assessing faculty members to come into high schools in particular are not working effectively. Sometimes the methods of assessment is a problem. Sometimes there are a lack of transparency, which is a major problem. Also, potentially, issues surrounding nepotism and even corruption, allegations of corruption have come to the forefront. So I think we need to recognize that there is a whole range of governance reforms that are needed to address that. But the heart of that governance reforms are also about creating a new vision for higher education in which the best and the brightest of India are thinking about being academics, being professors, and being teachers.
So thank you very much. Interesting talk. So what is the role that you see for the private institutions such as yours in this growing landscape? I know this is a relatively new concept of having private institutions, and I don't really understand completely how separate you are or from government regulation. I hear stories of interventions by government often in the governance structure of private institutions, but could you just both, what is the role you see of the private institutions and what is the level of autonomy you have to operate?
So the thing is that I've said one thing before. We in India it is not an exaggeration to say that we are living in the 19th, the 20th and the 21st century together. And so when I say that, it also means that there is a lot of innovations that are happening in higher education. There are lots of interesting ideas that are being promoted both from within the government and outside the government, as well as in private sector. There is an impetus within government to actually create opportunities for building world-class universities. For example, this budget, the current government has created a very revolutionary, in my view. In fact, 2 years ago, I wrote an article published in one of the Indian newspapers called The Hindu, in which I proposed the idea that government should fund 10 public and 10 private universities and actually give them complete autonomy and freedom and a fair amount of resources and to be able to position them as world-class universities. And that proposal has somehow creeped into the current budget. So there are such, those innovations are taking place. Of course, it's far fewer in number. As far as the public versus private is concerned, you know, in India, there is, in the higher education, there is nothing really private. The only distinction between the public and the private is that the founding resources is coming from the government and the taxpayers' money when it comes to public institutions, and it is coming from the benefactor or the promoter in the private university. Having said that, from you look at the governance structure and the regulation and the other rules and regulations which are applicable for it, all of which, if not more, ends up becoming applicable for the private universities. For example, our highest body is the governing body. The education secretary of the state of Haryana is an ex officio member of the governing body. The education secretary of the state of Haryana is also an ex officio member of the board of management. However, we are very fortunate that the government of Haryana has been absolutely supportive and has given us complete autonomy and freedom. But when I talk about this, I mean in terms of the institutional context in which these structures are created. Largely, it ends up becoming because of the concerned individuals at a given point of time are progressive and in many ways far-sighted in their approach. But that's not the story in many other institutions. So in a way, the so-called autonomy and independence of higher education institutions is about institutions themselves taking responsibility, faculty members and leaders within institutions taking responsibility to evolve creative institution building capacities. At present, that's not the case, and that's one of the reasons why we have not been able to build those institutions of excellence.
It's a couple of thoughts. I realize it's partly cultural, but the notion of philanthropy, that's perhaps not addressed. Yeah. And to what extent can philanthropy contribute to a strengthening of public higher education?
Yes.
And then the second one is perhaps related to brain drain. Is the government doing anything to attract Indian nationals who have gone overseas for higher education to come back and contribute to the higher education sector?
Yeah. The thing is that, first of all, on the philanthropy question, this is a very critical and very important one. We are very fortunate. Our university was created through a philanthropic initiative of our founding chancellor, Mr. Naveen Jindal. He had the privilege to study in the United States and was hugely inspired by his experience at the University of Texas in Dallas. But this is a very rare story in India. Typically, there are two types of institutions, as I mentioned, the public university, which is funded by the state, and the private universities, many of them, although ought to be not-for-profit, but frankly are sort of for-profit, dubious, commercial, mediocre, money-making enterprises. And I've always believed that private higher education needs to come from people who have established themselves very well in their business and are actually coming into higher education with a view to making a contribution and not to be able to get money out of it. At least the money that the university makes should not be the sole source of their income. And that's one of the mistakes that we made in the past. Talking about, what was the second question? The brain drain. I'll finish philanthropy, which is that we have not yet created an attractive environment for people to contribute. In fact, a few years ago, Narayana Murthy, who used to be the head of Infosys, which is a major IT company, he was chaired a committee set up by the then Planning Commission called the Narayana Murthy Committee on the Role of Private Sector in Higher Education. And it was a very comprehensive report which had government officials in it. And they suggested some very important reforms in the taxation structure, in the incentive structure, creating a fund for scholarships and a whole range of things, and also to recognize that there's the burden of a cost involved in it. The subsidies that are currently prevailing in the Indian public sector education needs to be funded by somebody, and that's what we need to create opportunities for private funding in public institutions, such as the thing that prevails here. But all of that has not happened. This government has been pretty progressive in initiating a few reforms, but I wish that they take the role of private higher education much more seriously than it is. In fact, today, over 60% of Indian students are actually studying in private higher education. So already the pendulum has swung. The bulk of Indian higher education in terms of student enrollments is not in the public sector. So that's a huge shift. This happened in the last decade only. As far as the brain drain is concerned, I personally don't think I wouldn't be worried about the issue of brain drain alone, in the sense that people coming from India and traveling and working in other parts of the world, I think world has enough, opportunities for people to make different contributions. But the larger question is, how do we attract some of those people to come into India? And there is a program that this government has initiated called the Global Indian something Gyan, which some resources have been put for inviting the leading academics from around the world to come back and spend a month or so or a semester, like a bit like Fulbright type of an Indian version. But, these are very small and its impact is much lesser. I think what would be very interesting is to see how we can innovatively build partnerships with the leading institutions here and other parts of the world and see how they can contribute quite substantively in India. In fact, I have elsewhere argued that, at the dawn of Indian independence, like IIT Kharagpur, for example, had very strong collaborations which led to, Harvard and MIT directly involved in, sort of establishing and evolving and in curriculum development and faculty development and all of that. Today, I have to confess that most academic institutions in the United States, including leading institutions, are not developing deep and pervasive collaborations. They do a little bit of, some exchange program, some conference, some sort of an individual-based collaboration between scholars. But I do think that the substantial contribution that has made some of those institutions truly transformative because of the leadership provided by the leading American institutions that happened in the 50s and 60s are no longer the case. I would strongly advocate that we need to go back to that, even identifying a few institutions which it need not be many, but substantial engagement where some sort of a mentorship, we can call it whatever. I know that these terms are all politically controversial and in different contexts. But the purpose of all of this exercise is to see how do you build institutional capacity within India. Please.
I had the mic.
Okay.
All right. Yeah, so I was actually just curious about how, now the India's current development story, which is sort of led by, the IT industry, be it, not very good quality IT jobs, but still IT industry, gives people a feeling, gives people a sense that they... Sorry, should I use that?
Yeah, okay. Go ahead.
So it gives people a sense that probably they can... that India's growth can be can continue even without investment in education. Because a lot of, people who are, in... not very good engineering colleges do manage to get pretty great jobs in terms of monetary value, whether we can comment on the quality of those. So how do you sort of subvert that?
It's delusional. Frankly speaking, that's not the case at all. We can think about it. So I'll give you some very interesting, rather sad statistics. In the state of one of the states in India, let's not name it, one of the states in India, they advertise for a job of an office attendant. In India, it's called the job of a peon, or office attendant, some sort of a helper person. There were some 2 million applicants for 100 positions or whatever. And there were some 120 engineering graduates, BTech, another 120 MTech, masters in technology, all kinds of other master's degree programs, some 200 plus PhD degree holders ended up applying for this position. Now, the point here is that the quality of education, and these are not fake degrees, these are real degrees given by real institutions, but just that the quality has been so poor that the education that they receive in the form of degrees in many of these institutions are really not valuable. And so, we really need to address, now the reason it has not yet been recognized elsewhere is the story of the few institutions which are really, world class in the sense of its students doing very well. But of course, and I think we need to go beyond the engineering as well. And then when you start looking at beyond the engineering, you look at different forms of arts and humanities and social sciences program. There is an even bigger crisis of both, unemployment as well as, lack of even basic knowledge that would have resulted in their degree awarded by the university. So in a way, we can be in denial for a long time, which we have been, but I don't think, there will be a time when this will stare at us. And that is also part of the what I would think the demographic dividend that we have will can potentially become a demographic disaster. And I do think that pockets of Indian governance system and the government and the leadership is recognizing it is doing a few things. But when we are in a crisis, unfortunately, marginal reforms are not going to see even marginal change. Radical reforms might actually end up seeing marginal change, and that's what we need.
So there are a number of countries that didn't have very very robust educational infrastructure and have created one in a comparatively short time through foreign partnerships. I'm thinking mostly of countries in the Middle East. Sure. But if you think of Qatar, for example, or Abu Dhabi. And I'm wondering, or even Saudi Arabia, I'm wondering why you think that hasn't happened in India.
Yeah. Well, I think the short answer is that because of the historical and colonial experience that we had in India, there was a large degree of skepticism that prevailed for a long time in relation to building collaborative endeavors. As in the collaborating, when you start collaborating, what do you really collaborate about? And to what extent, paternalism of institutions in the Western world could contribute and effectively undermine the ability of Indian institutions to grow. And frankly speaking, these are all exaggerated fears which do not have basis. But these have also contributed, even today, for example, international collaboration. I remember recently when I was, when we talked about international collaborations to a group of regulators, the response so much was that, why don't you collaborate within India? Of course, this need not be, if you collaborate outside India, that doesn't mean you don't want to collaborate within India. But even the idea that when you are collaborating with institutions around the world, that does, create some degree of awkwardness. And this may be also because of the fact that there is a certain degree of historical leadership that India had played at a point of time, and we have let that go. And so it's a little bit of an unfortunate defensive mechanism that gets demonstrated. But I think an informed understanding of what these collaborations are, and more importantly, the kind of leadership, intellectual leadership that India can provide if it is recognized better, and clearly we will find more engagement towards partnership. I think now more than ever, I see a lot more positive energy towards creating global partnerships. Of course, the Middle Eastern example, the way that has happened may not be the case in India. I mean, at the heart of it, India is a very vibrant democracy. The argumentative nature of Indian democracy will make sure that all of that is discussed, deliberated, and in a very vociferous and fierce manner. And when that happens, a new form of collaborative endeavors need to be evolved, in which both countries become intellectually, both institutions become intellectually engaged partners, as opposed to collaborations becoming a one-way street. The Middle East story is also about, the global universities of the West coming and setting up campuses and creating opportunities of learning there. And frankly speaking, while I support that and I think there is something to be said about it, it also needs to be recognized that the character of an institution is also not only shaped by these institutions being present in different places, but also the kind of experiences that students learn being part of an ecosystem. And that's a debate for another occasion. But I do think that some of which can be useful in the Indian context as well. And I'm seeing that change as we speak.
You know, and some of the early literature on world-class and rankings said that you couldn't, probably the best path to create a world-class university was to start a new one and not to have take old ones and try to convert them. I'd like your comment on that. And then the other thing relates to that is, at least my sense is that one of the foundational problems is a very strong civil service culture of the faculty, It isn't about performance. It's about how long you're in a position. How does that fit in, say, at your university? Do you have a different kind of pattern as to what you're doing?
So I'll answer the second part of it. You are absolutely right. Our vision when we started off the Jindal Global University was precisely to have a global, from the very beginning, we were very strong in the global imagination. We built a global curriculum, a global course structure, a global faculty, a global research agenda, all of which promoting global interaction. Nearly 20 to 25% of our faculty are non-Indian nationals recruited from around the world. And the rest of the 75% are people like me and my colleagues who have studied in India, studied overseas, and have returned to India. But we've also created an ecosystem which precisely addresses the point you mentioned, which is the faculty. We maintain a 1:10 faculty-student ratio. We maintain that because we want to create an ecosystem for advancing research. We need to fund research. We need to create research grants for faculty. We need to provide staff development leave and allowance for faculty. We need to provide research rewards, and excellence need to be promoted very consciously. So we are, and as you rightly said, I mean, that's, although I must confess that one of my inspiring experiences in the U.S. was the story of NYU. A very dear professor, friend of mine, Professor Norman Dorson, who teaches at NYU Law School, told me in the year 2000, when I was sitting in his office and talking about, you know, NYU, he said, you know, Raj, when I joined NYU 40 years ago, NYU was not a second-rate university, it was a third-rate university. And it was a shocking revelation for me, because I always knew NYU at that time, with the NYU's law school, the Stern Business School, the Furman School, and the medical school, to be leading institutions. But NYU's journey in the world of institutions, a transformation of a mediocre university to a world-class university in less than 3 decades, is unprecedented. And it, while it's a stellar example of what is possible for a transformation, I entirely agree with you that it is far more difficult to seek transformation of existing institutions than creating one. And that was our vision when we created the Jindal Global University. But having said that, I think it is important for us to recognize that it is a constant effort towards seeking excellence, and a whole range of efforts and initiatives are constantly provided. We are big in international collaborations. We believe that is the fulcrum around which great institutions need to be promoted, and some people don't agree with it, but we have done that. On that point, I will just close by saying that we have been very actively addressing the international collaboration agenda, where we have implemented 10 different forms of collaborations. These include faculty exchange programs, student exchange programs, joint teaching arrangements, joint research arrangements, joint conferences, joint publications, dual degree programs, summer schools, winter schools, study abroad programs, and joint executive education programs. But that vision is because of the fact that we believe we need to learn a lot from different institutional experiences and to partner with them so that we can actually provide the best of opportunities for our faculty and students.
Please thank President Kumar again.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.